Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
We're back at Sea Dreams today, the Southeast Asian podcast. And today I have An Vo and Phil Van to discuss coffee, which is a really big topic in Southeast Asia, and especially for Vietnam. In 2022, the world production was 10.8 million tons, with Vietnam being the second largest producer at 18%. And in the same year, these exports brought in 3.37 billion USD. This region of the world, specifically Vietnam, is very affected by coffee production. And I believe that Robusta is the number one coffee produced in the world by Vietnam.
Most of the Western world is generally familiar with the coffee bean that, you know, it's at Starbucks and coffee bean in Tea Leaf and Don't Coffee in Australia, etc. And a lot of that, almost all of that coffee is Arabica beans.
Arabica bean is sweeter, more of a European bean. It's fattier, probably leads to a smoother cup of coffee. It's not as bitter. And it's not as associated with potentially difficult flavors. Some people have compared like an average cup of Robusta to the taste of a rubber tire. But as we know, Robusta is the heart and soul of like a good cup of Vietnamese coffee.
I could see Phil holding back when he said tastes like a tire. What? Like a flat? What did you just say?
Yeah, people compare it to like a burnt rubber taste.
A burnt rubber taste, yeah. There's a lot of built-in arguing about Robusta and Arabica beans today. And we're going to get into the history, the facts, the emotional sort of the arguments behind all the things that represent, I think, Southeast Asia or Vietnamese culture as it relates to coffee production today and the marketing of coffee and everything about coffee in that region.
Yeah, it's hard not to personalize the discussion, just because if you're Vietnamese, part Vietnamese, if you're a fan of Vietnamese culture, if you're associated with Vietnam at all, like Robusta beans are the number one coffee export from Vietnam. Like, but Vietnam, it dominates in the Robusta bean industry.
But if you think about the way this is going to be explained and treated it throughout history, then I think this is when we're going to start to see a lot of parallels to how people in certain regions of the world are being treated.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's important to mention that if you look at the majority of really hip coffee restaurants, coffee cafes, like on the east side of Los Angeles or in Brooklyn, if you look at like Sight Glass Coffee or La Colombe or
Intelligentsia,
Blue Bottle, probably if you looked at Maru, if we can keep going, we can go to newer. If you looked at Camel, if you looked at a lot of these places, they would say on their site, it's somewhere that they were fueled by Arabica beans. A lot of these places will say that a coffee stock is 100% Arabica. But the irony is, when you start to get into more corp brands like Starbucks or Dunkin' Donuts or McDonald's, they are also touting that they are 100% Arabica. So there really isn't much of a line between this sort of progressive kind of hipster coffee culture and this giant sort of big business coffee conglomerate culture. And they're all touting Arabica as the source of their flavor, as the foundation of their coffee.
Okay, we're going to need to get started with the history, but I want to just bring up an interesting point. There's 120 something species of coffee. Arabica and Robusta are the two that land squarely in our discussion today, right? I mean, there's like four really marketed ones, but two that we're going to be talking about today. And we're going to talk about the Robusta bean today predominantly because it is what Vietnamese industry is built upon. And it was first introduced and documented in 1857 when a French Catholic priest brought it into northern Vietnam. An, you want to take over the history of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to when to our discussion of fur in our first session. You know, where fur, even though it's considered somewhat the national dish of Vietnam, it's a fairly recent phenomenon, pardon the pun. Same with coffee in Vietnam. It's only been since 1857 that Vietnam has actually been a producer of coffee, and we've imported that coffee culture that is very strong and very vibrant and very innovative in Vietnam from the French. And so when the French came over in 1857 via the French colonists, but also the Roman Catholic Church, they brought over their kind of like predilection for Arabica beans. And that was what was first cultivated in Vietnam, in the highlands of Vietnam, was Arabica. But they soon ran into problems with that.
Yeah. There was a coffee leaf rust epidemic that decimated the crops between 1940 and 1954. Arabica couldn't survive basically the COVID of coffee. And it left these Vietnamese coffee farmers without much to grow or sell until they discovered the power of Robusta beans, which were immune to the coffee leaf rust disease. And they were able to grow these at a higher yield. They were more resilient, and they were in a way a symbol of the resiliency and sort of survival instinct of the people who were growing them.
Yeah. And so what we see is that, you know, Robusta being cultivated in the 1900s, and then what really, you know, rocket fueled the spread and the production of Vietnamese Robusta coffee is the economic reforms of 1987 within Vietnam.
That's crazy. Think about that. So in 1857, they brought one tree. This French Catholic priest brought one tree. They brought one tree, and then they tried it. And then it wasn't really till the early 1900s that this thing like really took off. But in those 43 years, like nothing really happened. Four decades of a tree being in Vietnam and nothing really happens. They probably tried because it's Arabica and it doesn't grow in that region, you know, doesn't grow in Southeast Asia, but it could have not happened if you think about it.
Yeah, there's lots of accidents of history, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And again, like fur, I see the parallel between the development of fur and the development of coffee. Sometimes it's an accident of history, sometimes it's fortuitous circumstances. So in this respect, they found that the Robusta was highly adapted to the environments, to the soil culture, etc. of Highlands Vietnam. It's amazing, right? So let's fortuitous. So let's put that in the cup back there.
Well, and then you have this my economic reforms of 1987, which is arguably like another weird chapter in Vietnam's history, because after 1975, you know, we're looking at almost famine happening after the war. You know, I think the Vietnamese government reaches out actually to the U.S. government right after. You know, 6 months after, they're calling up the U.S. government saying, we need help. But they couldn't get the whole MIA thing situated. So they didn't, you know, bodies weren't being returned and all that. But then, so it takes until 1987 to kind of like have these economic reforms, and then coffee makes a comeback, right?
Yeah, it kind of explodes from that point in time, because it becomes one of the leading exports of Vietnam. Now, in between, you know, the 1850s and then in 1987, there's a lot of coffee culture being brewed within Vietnam, right? The cafes, the rooftop cafes in Saigon, for example, where it's a respite from the hot and humidity of summer, right? There's the innovation of replacing milk with sweetened condensed milk. And that's when we talk about Vietnamese coffee now in the last 10 years that it's gained traction within the US and Australia and Canada and other Western countries, we think of a sweet coffee, which is kind of anathema to what many people think of as coffee, right? For them, it's coffee is a latte or Americano, et cetera, where it's fairly, there is a coffee flavor and there's a slight milk flavor, but it's you don't tend to drink it with lots of sugar.
Right? Yeah.
Whereas Vietnamese coffee is, the sugar is like front and center almost, as well as a big kick.
And what's interesting is it comes from an unmet need, right? They were trying to import milk. The culture of drinking coffee with milk was from France. They couldn't keep the milk refrigerated, so they had to find some other way. And condensed milk, you could ship in cans. You didn't need refrigeration.
Right? You know, I never knew that.
Yeah,
Before I started like researching this stuff, I did not know that.
It's almost like a war ration, and it comes from the same place that pho does, right? Because
necessity,
the kind of thrown away bones of cattle became the soup stock that defined sort of a national dish. And in this case, the condensed milk is also sort of it comes out of
necessity, the mother of invention.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Same with like egg coffee, right?
Yeah.
So egg coffee, the same thing is when you don't have access to sugar, when you don't have access to milk, when you don't have access to sweetened condensed milk, what do? You look at chickens and eggs, really. I want to put some of that came out of the chicken's butt into my coffee, you know? And
but so, there's this idea of creamy yolk, as a replacement.
Yeah.
What's so interesting is you brought up coffee never being as big of a thing as it now is, and the evolution of it. And I think the way that intersects with like the French colonial rule and sweetened milk is that the Arabica bean itself is sweeter, right? So if you add sweetened milk on top of the Arabica bean, like if you did the same combination that you do to Vietnamese coffee to like an American cup of coffee, right? A typical Starbucks and or bougie hipster cup of coffee, it would be overall too sweet. But the Robusta bean, once that came into favor, was bitter enough to counter the flavor of the condensed milk. So it became sort of the perfect combination, the perfect mix. There was a real contrast to those tastes.
All right, I'm going to bring in something modern because you just brought that up. There is a lot of these places in LA that serve Vietnamese coffee with Arabica, and it's super weird to drink. You're like, wait, this doesn't taste like Vietnamese coffee, and this is the reason why.
Yeah.
When did you first notice that? Was it last year? Last year?
No, last 10 years. Last 10 years.
Really?
Yeah. When I first started seeing it was maybe 10 years ago, where? Vietnamese coffee. I don't quote me, but Mendocino Farms, I think, or was it the Mendocino Farms at Banh Mi? But it's one of those, right, models that it's like chains. That are serving Vietnamese coffee. You see it like in Venice, you see it in Silver Lake all the time. And it's Vietnamese coffee.
What's their definition, do you think, of Vietnamese coffee?
I've asked. Some guys know, some don't. Some people know, some people don't. Like a friend of mine opened a cafe up in Mid-City, and I asked his head guy, his GM, and this guy broke it down. He said, yeah, we use Robusta here, blah, 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 blah. This brand wasn't acidic enough, and this kind of milk. And, he broke it down. And it was an African-American gentleman, he's a GM of this Mid-City high-end cafe. He broke it down. But, it ain't Vietnamese coffee like Café Ciudad that you get, across the street from here. In the San Gabriel Valley or Orange County. And what makes it, because honestly, we all grew up with these orange Café du Monde cans, but that's not really what is taste.
So Café du Monde, for those at home who don't know, they come in these orange kind of cans, and they're out of New Orleans in Louisiana. And I didn't know this until quite recently, is that Café du Monde is known for putting chicory spice into their coffee. So for me growing up in Australia, where my parents would buy Café du Monde coffee cans and make Café Ciudad, for me, that was the quintessential Vietnamese coffee.
Right, yeah.
But for many people in Vietnam, they don't use chicory in their robusta coffee.
No, at all. And all over the United States in the diaspora, Café du Monde was the brand that, you know, when you drink Café Seda, you think of, you see this orange can. But when you go to Vietnam, it's nothing like that.
There's no chicory in there.
No, there's no chicory. It's just like the weirdest, like, thing that's imprinted in your mind here.
Let me ask you this: when we say Vietnamese coffee, what picture is it that comes to mind in your mind?
That's a great question. That's a really good question because I've thought about that since I saw it in here in LA.
Yeah.
I think about that all the time. I was hoping that we can answer that today.
Answer, like, what's the picture when I say Vietnamese coffee, Ken? Let's go for Vietnamese coffee. What do you have?
I can tell you what the sensory feeling is.
Right,
there's an acute projection out of my nostrils. That's strongly coffee. That's not Colombian coffee. Not Nestle coffee. This is like a
very distinct
like punch that comes out of my nose, and it feels like you're on rocket fuel. Right when you drink it, there's a spike. There's a sudden rush of like this spike in your body.
Is that the caffeine? Was that the sugar? Or is it?
I think all of it. Okay. I think all of it. But that's what I think when I drink coffee.
So that's the sensation, the taste, the flavor.
All of it. Yeah.
I think I picture pouring hot coffee over ice, and then sipping it. And I think it's maybe the first time or first couple of times I tried it. It's always my dad's coffee, usually at like a pho restaurant, and the immediate flavor was bitterness. Distinct bitterness, and then it was countered by the sweet of the milk, and they were both at opposite ends of the spectrum, and they kind of explode your taste buds. And I didn't really notice when I was younger the caffeine right away, or that it wasn't. It was just that it was so they were two such opposed flavors hitting at the same time.
But I wonder how many kids out there tried to make a face it out with Folgers, or you know what are those little things that you pop K-cups. In the machine? The what?
K cups.
Yeah, the K cups. Yeah. It doesn't work. The flavor is not there.
No.
What then? What is it? What are we describing?
When someone says Vietnamese coffee to me, it's very distinct. So one is robusta beans. Second is sweetened condensed milk.
Mm-hmm.
Third is the coffee filter, the Vietnamese coffee filter, which is called the fin.
Yeah.
And fourth is the separate glass of ice.
Yeah.
And then the fifth is the actual process and experience of it. So for me, it's watching, putting the coffee filter, the fin, onto the first glass. Before you put the fin onto the glass, you put in, you know, a
condensed
centimeter
milk.
Or two of sweetened condensed milk. Put the fin on, put the coffee grounds in, screw the filter down, and pour in a boiling cup or so of hot water. Right, and put the lid back onto the thing, and then you wait for 5 minutes as you see the drops fall down from the filter into the cup. And in that 5 minutes or so, we're talking to the person beside you, talking about troubles of the day, et cetera, et cetera. And for me, that's part of the experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why you go have coffee. And then once you know that all the water is thrown, come out of the fin, you transfer that coffee and sweetened condensed milk that you've stirred into the second cup of ice.
Yeah.
Right. And then that means that you have a second round of talk. So it's a whole process where it's
a ritual.
It's a ritual.
All right.
A ritual.
For me, that was a very beautiful and mysterious process. I would sit with my father and it would last almost the whole meal. He would just let it percolate. And I always wondered how it worked. And he'd reach inside and push the filter down a little to get it bolder.
I got a story about this.
And at the end of the meal, he'd pour it in.
Yeah.
And then he would sip it slowly. And that was sort of the demarcation
It is a ritual. And I think you go to Italy, you go to France, and it's the same ritual, right? Whether it's a French press or whatever, it's a occasion for you to, and a signal for you to take things slowly, appreciate life, and appreciate the connections you can make with the people beside you. I think that to me, that is what Vietnamese coffee is.
But we need to get back to the flavor though, because this is not the story I was, You reminded me of one of the first dates I ever had in my life. I think I was 16 or 17, and I met this girl, I think at one of these Orange County decathlons, academic decathlons. And she was like, "Do you like coffee?" And I thought to myself, "Yeah, like, of course, everybody likes coffee." But she's like, "No, like Vietnamese coffee." I was like, "Yeah, sure." She's like, let's meet at a Vietnamese coffee shop. It could have been right after high school. Then we meet up. I drive down there, we meet up, and then we sit down, and the fiend comes out with the glass and everything, and she sits down. She immediately takes the fiend and she pours it into the second cup with the ice. She was so nervous or something, you know? She was so nervous that she just poured the hot water that was sitting in the fiend into the second. But I think about that, and I think about that often and reflect about how much that turned me off at the time, right? But as a human being, the growth of becoming somebody who can understand, like, that shouldn't turn you off, right? Like, I really grew from that experience, and I would never forget that. I can't let something like that turn me off just because somebody made this mistake. And it always stuck with me, that sort of that memory of that first coffee cup, first coffee date when I was in my teens, saying don't ever judge somebody because they don't know the process. And it's such a natural thing for us to look into the outside world and judge everything because people don't know our culture.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting too, because I think one of the things that is very attractive about Vietnamese coffee culture is that it's a very simple process.
It is.
Right? It's
if you
coffee,
know it.
Coffee grounds into a sin or basically
a filter.
A filter, right? And you put water in and that's it.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the experience around it is actually not making the coffee. It's about talking to people beside you. Now,
smoking that, and sitting and shooting the breeze.
Contrast that with the American sophisticated coffee culture where you have to tamp down, you've got this $4,000 coffee machine and you have to make sure that the ground is 0.05 millimeters. You know, there's a lot of kind of work and a lot of kind of like fruitfulness around that, right? And it's about the coffee and the product versus about the experience and the connection you make through enjoying the culture.
I agree. And I think it's so simple that it's deceptive because it produces such a specific and bold taste. Yeah. And I remember the first thin I got, I think someone in my family sent it to me and I had it. And I have all the contraptions. Like I have a stainless steel French press with no silicone, you know, so there's no carcinogenic qualities to it. I have a Chemex, I have a Breville espresso machine. So I tamp and I stretch milk and I know how to aerate a good latte. I worked as a barista for a little while at a Starbucks, right, when I was in college. So like, I really love coffee, but nothing really stood out to me and was as impressive as like a cup of Vietnamese coffee growing up with my dad. So the first fin I got, I actually thought there was something else to it. I hadn't really invested until I owned one. I didn't investigate it. And I thought there was a screw mechanism. I thought maybe there's a way you push it down. Maybe there's a tamp built in the way it kind of percolates through. And I couldn't believe that it just sat there with gravity, floated on the water and just did the work for you.
Perfection in simplicity. Right?
Absolute simplicity. And it made no sense. And then I realized that it was the whole endeavor. It was the type of condensed milk and it was the beans.
But you know what's really weird? Like you can make a cup of coffee and my uncle can make a cup of coffee and yours or mine does not taste authentic. I've lived through this for years. I was like, couldn't figure out. And I still to this day, my uncle makes a cup of coffee and I make a cup of coffee. It doesn't taste right. There's something about the way he makes it, the way he packs it, just the right amount. Or I don't know what he does. I don't know how many scoops he puts in. It's just the right power. It's the right flavor.
So I've got a few markers I want to place down. But one of the markers I want to place down is the sheer simplicity of Vietnamese coffee, the fin, the filter. Is that what is preventing it being widely adopted and being seen as sophisticated amongst Western kind of connoisseurs?
No, I don't know.
They don't get to tamp down. They don't get to fine grain the ground and stuff like that, right? There's no process there.
I have an answer, but it's sort of a cynical one. And okay. I think the taste is too explosive,
yeah,
and too dynamic,
yeah,
for the West to fully comprehend.
I completely agree with that.
I think you have some Westerners, some white people really understand it, but the vast majority don't. And what they want is something vanilla and
subtle.
Subtle is a wonderful and positive way to put
nuanced
it.
Nuanced and subtle. But sure, let's fight, because I know you want
to. Another way to put it.
I know you don't want to fight me on this, but I know you want to. I know you want to get testy about this whole thing.
Can I get a counter to that?
Sure.
I'll put a counter to that. The counter is the explosion in the popularity of coffee and sugar drinks like Red Bull.
Even Starbucks. It's all sugar.
Yeah. But again, I can't drink Red Bull because the coffee steam, the bitterness is so...
I think Phil is talking about something else.
Though. Yeah. Yeah. Phil? I would keep it squarely in the court of coffee, because if you get into Red Bull, you get into why Midwestern sort of suburban white dads only drink like Diet Coke and won't even touch coffee. That's crazy. That's just imbibing on chemicals like for 30 years. Right. But coffee to coffee, I think the reason this is so hot button for me anyway, is that there is a clear fight going on in corporate America. It's an intercontinental battle, and there's two sides. So it's a very, very specific debate. And one side is team Robusta, and the other side is team Arabica.
I think this is what the audience came for.
Yeah, absolutely. And one side is very Eurocentric, and the other one is really a window into the Asian world, into the flavors of Southeast Asia and Vietnam specifically. And Vietnamese coffee, which seems deceptively simple, is actually like just a window into how the palate of Vietnamese cuisine sort of functions and what it represents, and the balance of really dynamic and opposed flavors. And the bitterness is a huge part of that. And I think that terrifies a lot of Westerners, just how just maybe potentially off-putting that is on first blush.
I think when we describe the taste that you asked in the beginning, I think that has to be like front and center is the bitterness. When you drink a Vietnamese cup of Café Seda, that's the first thing you're going to get hit with. It's like a knife. It just cuts your tongue, and it's super bitter. And then when you drink a latte from one of these, you know, Silver Lake places, it's just a very nuanced caffeine.
But what's interesting is, in New York, like when La Colombe was just coming up, right? And now it's sort of an institution. I would get their hyper-caffeinated like iced coffee. They'd put two espresso, two doubles.
Yeah,
cold brew coffee.
Yep.
Just because I wanted to be awake after whatever, working all night or something. Yeah, I would get this coffee to just sort of energize. And it vaguely approximated the hit I would get, like the feeling I would get from a cup of Vietnamese coffee.
Yeah.
But it wasn't quite there, because they were still obsessing over Arabica.
It's not just the flavor, it's the feeling you get when you drink a Vietnamese cup of coffee.
It is. Yeah. But also genuinely the chemistry. Because I think if you characterize both kinds of coffee bean, right, and you say, all right, Arabica is widely accepted by the West, especially by high-end coffee companies, and Robusta is sort of considered the kitchen staff in the back, right? It might be mixed into coffee blends. Like you might get a coffee blend at Whole Foods or Trader Joe's, and there might be some Robusta mixed in if it's a morning blend, but they won't advertise that it's mixed in, because it's sort of the dirty laundry almost of the coffee bean world, right? So if you look at it that way, and you ask yourself, like, well, what are the dynamics and the characteristics of both beans, right? If you said one bean is higher in fat and higher in sugar and less caffeinated, you would expect that to be the
winner.
I would expect that to be the lesser
loser.
I would expect that to be the crap bean, right? But that's Arabica. Robusta not.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. Robusta, absolutely. That's what I meant.
Yeah. Robusta's not. Oh, the winner of the bean fight.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, but Arabica not only is more sugary, not only is fattier, is more akin to the diabetes of coffee beans, but it also, and no shade on anyone with diabetes, but it also has less caffeine. It's harder to grow. So I mean, there's so many reasons why like Robusta makes sense, and why when you get hit with that explosive feeling, it is actually happening to you, because it is sort of, at least if you come to coffee for a punch, not only for the caffeination but also the taste, right? Robusta offers all of that. Sorry that I sound like an ad for Robusta.
No, I'm desperately trying to find an analogy for all this, and I cannot find it. I can't find it. I'm trying to find some analogy to kind of like shape the way I see Robusta and Arabica, the taste, the pros, the cons, the way it's being perceived. And I can't really find it. And I'm usually always getting analogies kind of like naturally, but I it's a very unique war.
Can I read a statement from he calls himself the coffee engagement manager at Starbucks.
Please.
His name's Aaron Robinson, and this is on their website. And I found this in like 30 seconds of searching. It says, comparing the two coffee beans. At first glance, Robusta might seem like the preferable tree. It's more resistant to diseases, drought, and pests. Grows at lower altitudes, produces more coffee cherries, and is cheaper. So what's the problem? Well, the flavor. It comes down to flavor. And that less refined flavor is absolutely the reason we don't ever even touch it. We don't even touch it is such a specific turn of phrase. And it just triggered a lot of memories, which people have used phrases like that in the past, not about coffee.
So now we're getting to an analogy. Yeah. Like, what are you getting at?
This is an untouchable bean, according to Aaron Robinson, the coffee engagement manager at Starbucks. This is an untouchable bean that comes from an untouchable place. That is not something befitting of the standards of a company like Starbucks. The high quality flavor of Arabica beans is grounded in elevation. Arabica trees thrive at higher altitudes than Robusta, typically between 3,000 and 6,000 feet. At these elevations, hot days and cool nights slow down the growth of coffee cherries. This gives the cherries and the coffee beans inside more time to develop, creating a more refined flavor. It can be elegant. It can be complex. It can have body and acidity that is interesting and can be used and played with and blended into new, interesting tastes, Robinson said. That's why Starbucks only buys Arabica beans. At the end of the day, our heart is in quality, Robinson said.
See, I'm trying to bring this analogy of a car in or some work of art, like a movie, a song to compare it. And I can't wrap my, I don't know why I'm looking for this analogy, but I think when you start talking about untouchable, I start thinking about untouchable castes in India. I start getting that feeling.
Oh, yeah.
I start getting this feeling of discrimination that you're describing, but I can't really...
Cultural superiority.
Yeah.
But I can't find what to compare this to right now.
I think I can... Let me take a stab at it. Like we talked about in the first episode, right? It's contrasting the ability of the subtle flavors of a spaghetti pasta dish, right?
Where they can $50
versus a bold, brash, vibrant flavors of a bowl of pho that we can only sell for $13-$15, right? And the only reason in my mind that can happen is because of the cultural cachet that is being attached by the tastemakers in society, Western society, to what they've known previously. That was imported from the old world, from France, from Italy, from Germany, except from England.
Okay, so all right. Well, then let me take it to Japanese sushi culture.
Yeah.
Then are we in the world internationally saying the more nuanced, the more sort of refined things are, that's where the money and the cachet and the price point should be? Because if you think about sushi, right, like everything about sushi generally is nuanced, right? The higher you end, you go with the omakases at $800 a pop, it's very subtle taste, right? And you've made the argument that it's a cultural cachet, but it's also nuance you're paying for. Because you go to like a cheap sushi place for like $30, all you can eat, it's like in your face, and it's a little bit more punchy. Coffee might be the same. Are we saying that anything that's nuanced and refined needs to be more expensive because there's a process?
to it? Well, I think the concept of sophistication, the word itself, or the concept of sophistication, kind of lends itself on, or kind of reinforces this other related notion of nuance and kind of minor detail, right? So I have to be sophisticated enough in order to be able to discern these minor changes in flavor profile. Therefore, I must be intelligent or must be super duper good. But so contrast that with bold, brash, blah, 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 where any fool, quote unquote, fool can actually discern that, right? And so therefore, less sophistication is required in order to enjoy that kind of flavor profile.
Yeah, I agree with all that, but I also think there's something even sort
sinister.
Of more sort of sinister, certainly, but even kind of blunter and dumber about the argument, which is not, we should address, which is just that, like, I don't think Aaron Robinson of Starbucks likes anything close to the flavor of Robusta. I think he finds Robusta disgusting and the entire sort of ideology behind it. I think he's probably tried it. And assuming this is a real and authentic point of view of his, the way that he's talking about it, we will not even touch this.
Yeah.
Right? That is like, you are despicable and disgusting.
But I think he's the tip of the spear in the West.
He is. But I actually put credence in. I think he really does find something so bold, shocking, and offensive. I think he's shocked and offended by it in a way that that is not unfamiliar. Like, he thinks it's too loud. He thinks it's too brash. He thinks it
he thinks it's hip hop.
He thinks it's hip hop.
it's new world and not old money.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. It offends his gentilian sensibilities, and he thinks that it somehow is in betrayal of the laws of social etiquette.
Man, right? I knew I liked Phil. I told you I liked this guy. I think you're onto something. I think you're really onto something. So we're stretching this argument to say that Robusta Vietnam produces a lot of this stuff, number one in the world, right? Yeah. And basically this guy,
40% of Robusta comes from
Vietnam. So you're basically, we take offense to what this guy's saying about we take it personally, because it almost, if you think about it, there's parallels to the taste of Robusta coffee in Vietnam to our people. Yeah. We're loud, we're brash, we're like, we sometimes we don't need to be refined. I mean, you go to Saigon and you go to all parts of Vietnam, it's just really loud and in your face, and yeah, it's real.
Yeah.
But Western society is not like that.
Right. No. And to suggest, like, coming back from Vietnam, you notice the difference right away, right? Suddenly the streets are quiet and everything feels cleared out. And you're like, are we on a sound stage here? I'm not sure. Yeah, I think to look at that vibrancy and that volume, and to say nothing good can come out of this. There is no real culture. There's no flavor. There's no taste. There's no art. There's no discernment. There's no judgment. It's just primitive nonsense.
Well, you know,
that's what I hear when I hear this argument.
Who said that? I think right before the Vietnam War kicked off, one of these guys, not Churchill, one of these guys said the same thing about Asians, people in Asia, Southeast Asia. They don't know anything. God, I got to look up this quote. They're basically savages.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. God, I feel so dumb right now. Not being able to figure out exactly who said it. But that is the reason the Vietnam War was allowed to happen, because this, I can't remember, is a general or some chief of staff, or he said publicly said that the Southeast Asians have no discernment. They have no clue of what the real world is all about. And this is what is being justified in refined society.
Henry Kissinger.
There we go. Kissinger.
Kissinger.
Kissinger is
the guy. We need to do a session on Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, Kissinger.
Let's put a note down on that.
We got to edit that. No, we're not going to edit this out. But Kissinger. Kissinger said, "Can you read exactly what Kissinger said?
If you give me a minute."
Yeah, because what Kissinger is saying and what we are comparing the parallels to coffee is almost very identical, because what we're saying is that when you shut down a taste or a flavor profile of this entire region and comparing it to somebody who has no discernment, you're basically telling a whole core group of people in a certain part of the world that they don't really understand what taste is about.
Yeah, it's a bit like gatekeeping, and you kind of see echoes of it in the wine world, right? Back in until like the 1960s and 70s, when a team of European, essentially, wine connoisseurs and wine experts judged the World Wine Contest and blind tasting, and it was actually an American wine that won from Napa Valley. And that's sort of like kind of democratized and globalized wine production away from old world
Europe,
right, into the new world from North American and South American wines. Again, it's gatekeeping. It's kind of like colonial kind of, what's the word? I wouldn't call it racism, but colonial outlook on this is what sophistication, this is what panel
but, tier, and you can also make the argument that the world is set up that way. Even in Vietnam, it's set up that way. In the old royal courts were set up that way. You know, the nuance, the mandarins, the people who knew versus the people who didn't know. You still look it up, Phil?
Quote, man.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Phil will find the quote.
Again, like, this has back to our the beginnings of this particular session. What is Vietnamese coffee, and how has Western chains like Starbucks or Intelligentsia or whoever who are offering a Vietnamese coffee solution, right? But they're using Arabica beans, not using the fin, the filter, the metal filter, right? They're using some. How are they adapting Vietnamese coffee, or are they appropriating Vietnamese coffee and not respecting the sophistication of Vietnam and Southeast Asia? But that's my question. Right. At what point does Vietnamese coffee lose its Vietnameseness? At what point do we, as Vietnamese people, Southeast Asian people, are able to give up, or how comfortable are we giving up authorship of what is Vietnamese coffee?
Well, what's interesting is, unlike the pho discussion, where it's actually remarkably hard to emulate a good bowl of pho, right? Like even Vietnamese chefs in certain communities will be competitive about their recipes and are looking for the ultimate bowl to sell to their customer base. Vietnamese coffee is really easy to make, right? If you get the right bean and you have the right filter, the right fin, and you have the right condensed milk, anyone can make it. And I think the issue is more when you see the westernized version of Vietnamese coffee, like the one you were describing. The issue is more like that whichever Western restaurant owner chef decided to adapt that coffee for his restaurant to sort of gentrify the coffee, also decided to improve upon the flavor, right? And has decided to maybe use Arabica beans instead of Robusta, or I don't know, to add something to the coffee that shifts it up. Maybe it's his own form of condensed milk that's not really condensed. I mean, however he's improving upon it is completely altering what it is, and it ceases to be what he's purporting it is.
Is that adaptation? Is that innovation? Or is it kind of a corruption of what Vietnamese coffee is?
I don't know. I was thinking the same question when you were talking about it. I don't know. I don't know if some guys are trying to improve it and make it better or make it their own, and then some guys just don't know, and they just know, okay, it's condensed milk and just black coffee.
I think there's a really simple distinction. If you have a true appreciation for what it is, like for what actual good Vietnamese coffee is, and then you find some way to adapt or change that recipe, some new spin you want to put on it that makes your cup unique, right? And you might be Vietnamese, you might not be, but whoever you are, I think that pays homage to where the taste comes from, and you understand clearly the lineage of taste, and you understand what you're innovating upon. So it is innovation. It is. I don't think it's improvement. I think it's lateral, but I think it is creative interpretation at that point. But I think if you don't truly understand or appreciate the flavor, if you taste it and, like Aaron Robinson, just have issues with the bitterness, with the sweet, with anything that a good cup of Vietnamese coffee represents, and you say, I know how to fix this. If you're like the white husband in Joy Luck Club who puts soy sauce all over
the rice,
right? Because he says, oh, you just need a little salt and you know how to fix the flavor. You've officially corrupted the coffee.
Yeah.
And there's no going back.
Yeah.
That's it. You shouldn't be making the coffee. You shouldn't be consuming it. And you certainly shouldn't be using its name to sell your product.
Okay. So let me break down my definition of Vietnamese coffee, right? Let's say there's three elements, right? There's Robusta beans, there's sweetened condensed milk, and third is using a coffee filter or fin.
Right.
At what point does it break down into not being Vietnamese coffee? Like, let's say you got a Starbucks.
Arabica. That's one.
Yeah, that would be. Yeah, change the beans.
Yeah. Right. And then just putting creamer and sugar in it. That's another. That's the second. It has to be condensed milk.
Okay.
And there's actually brands of condensed milk that make it taste a certain way. So I would throw that in.
So it's the beans. It's definitely one. That's fundamental to being. It's a fundamental characteristic of Vietnamese coffee.
I think you could potentially.
Is using the fin also fundamental?
I think you could potentially brew it without the fin, but I think I would argue that's difficult. Like, I would just use the
fin. I don't know, man.
I would just use the fin. You know?
I don't think you can brew Vietnamese coffee without a fin.
Yeah, maybe not. I mean,
never had it.
I've never had it, actually. So, yeah.
When you go
never had it.
A fin is so cheap, right? Yeah. That so, why wouldn't you use a fin?
Yeah.
It's cheaper than any other brewing alternative.
I've gone to Western restaurants. I've gone to Vietnamese restaurants and delis where I order Vietnamese coffee, and it doesn't come out of a fin. They're just pulling it up from out of somewhere. Like, I get offended by that.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's like coffee, those three elements of the fin, the robusta bean, and sweetened condensed milk. If any one of those three is missing, then it's not Vietnamese coffee to me.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting.
But then you got this whole thing about commercial kind of pressure of having your order ready there, right there. So I understand where the fin is taken out of the equation.
But now the fin in Vietnam is not taken. Well, they have a big fin. Have you guys seen the big fins? There's big fins, probably 10 inches in diameter, and they pack it, and then they brew hot water, and they let it do its thing.
That's okay. That's commercial science.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know how that affects the actual flavor. You have to think about ratios, right?
Yeah.
Like grounded coffee beans ratio to the fin, and how much you have in that big 10-inch fin. But you see it in Vietnam all the time. So they're brewing like a pitcher of a café sida. So that's a new thing that I've seen in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years in Vietnam.
So when we go to a Western establishment or even a Vietnamese or Asian establishment where they skimp out on one of the three, right? The robusta, sweetened condensed milk, and using the fin. Dare we say, are we arguing that that's not Vietnamese coffee?
Of course, I agree with that.
But how do you feel about it being offered by a Western kind of establishment?
The proper café sida?
And then representing it as, this is Vietnamese coffee. Are you okay with that?
No, I'm not.
As far as, hey, I see this as an opportunity to broaden the reach of Vietnamese coffee to...
That's like building a Chinese motorcycle and putting a Vespa sticker or label on it. No, I'm not okay with that. Okay. I'm not okay with...
So when you say you're not okay with that, do you voice it to the establishment or do you just go
that's a great question
and write down an anonymous Google review?
That's a great question.
I think you voice it to whoever you're with. You kind of say, you kind of under your breath, you murmur, it's not real Vietnamese coffee to whoever you're with. That's the most you really voice it typically in a public situation. You could go write a review. I don't know. You know, I guess it might help some people. It reminds me of the Kanji Queen scandal. Oh, there's a white chef lady in Oregon who was making kanji, claiming she was cleaning up kanji for a Western audience and making a very lukewarm, watered down version of kanji. and that's sort of, I think you're kind of purchasing the Kanji Queen's kanji when you drink that sort of Vietnamese coffee, right?
I think we have a responsibility to call out anything that doesn't make sense to us, whether it's putting a Vespa sticker on a Chinese motorbike or coffee that's not made in the right language. If you know it, you should like voice it, I think. But I mean, that's a lot easier said than done, right? That's just a lot easier because it's like these baristas probably don't know. That GM that I talked to, he probably doesn't really understand the true taste of it. But I'm going to question him. I did go up to him and go, hey, can you explain why you have Vietnamese coffee on the menu? What is your, what's the definition? Because I mean, I do want to know why people call it that too. You know, I'm curious. Why do you call it this? Labor of the month,
essentially? I think they're just coasting off the cachet, but the trend, right?
Yeah.
The feeling that they're welcoming in a certain amount of diversity, that they're worldly.
Is it performative or is it an actual substantive?
I think it's a mix of
commercial viability.
It's a mix of like allyship, performance, and then also probably some appreciation, but for the fact that that was too sharp a flavor. I liked it, but I would kind of take it down. That's sort of the vibe, I think. And it's like, well, if you would take it down, then you don't really appreciate what it is.
Right.
And you actually just want it to be like what you know, what you grew up with in, you know, Minnesota or something. So it's not, it's a mixed bag. But look, the history of all things popular is they get watered down, right? Fashion trends become like the sort of lame style of the next gen, whatever, for the next generation. So it's like, as Vietnamese coffee kind of goes global and passes a certain saturation point threshold, like, yeah, you have to expect, you know, they don't know copyright. They don't know royalties to anyone. People can use the term however they see fit. It's just anyone that actually understands. I think it's just staying informed and knowing what you're actually getting. Anyone that actually understands what Vietnamese coffee should be should ideally shut down that, like, just by not voting for it, by not buying the product.
Can we return real quick to the quote? Do you have that found?
I didn't find it.
You couldn't find it?
Not yet. Well, no, it's such a popular quote.
You're sure it's Kissinger, right?
It's Kissinger.
Okay, yeah. While you're looking for that, I have something else that I, speaking of what's authentic and what's real and all this jazz, right? Durian coffee. Have any of you had it?
No.
Okay. I've had durian coffee. I mean,
tell me how it's made.
Well, I haven't. I've just had it in pre-mixed
powdered.
Yeah. I guess they're powdered because I was in Hanoi and I was like, I needed some coffee one morning and it was like 5:30 in the morning. Nobody was open except this one lady. I roll up to her stand and she sat me down. She goes, I only have durian coffee. Is that okay? I was like, I love durian. I love coffee. Let's rock. She made it and she poured it. And I was like, how come I didn't think about this years and years and years ago? But I can imagine getting fresh durian and just whipping it into the thing with a little bit of condensed milk to make it like real durian coffee, right?
Yeah.
You seem excited about it.
First of all, I love durian, right? And second of all, I see this as a lot of innovation, right? I think Western coffee culture is kind of fairly staid and very conservative. Yes, you got the Starbucks where they just put in lots of different weird flavors, but it's not really, it doesn't accentuate the coffee flavor, you know, the frappuccinos and all that. It's actually not. It's just candification or lollification of coffee.
Yeah.
And that's not real innovation in coffee culture. So I came to the States in 2005. It took me 7 years, and I lived in New York and DC. It took me 7 years before I could find a flat white in the US. 7 years. And this was at a time in 2005, 2000 onwards, was the explosion of coffee culture, first, second wave coffee culture in the US. But it took me 7 years to find flat white. And so from my mind, that is just an indication of how kind of not innovative coffee culture, Western coffee culture is. But to hear you, Ken, about your experiences about egg coffee, sweetened condensed milk coffee, durian coffee, back in 2010-ish, was around, everyone in the US was exploding around civet coffee, which is the Vietnamese poop coffee, where the coffee beans are eaten by this
ferret.
A ferret
yeah.
In Vietnam, and
yeah,
yeah. Poops it out, and in between the alimentary canal, there's some enzyme.
That was huge.
It was huge.
Huge. Jung Nguyen made it popular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And so for me, that is kind of some kind of like innovation in the coffee culture scene. And I think.
But that's been around for like many, many decades in Vietnam, right?
But things like trying different flavors or innovating on coffee, I think the innovation is much more prevalent in Vietnamese coffee culture than in Western coffee.
But who thought about that? Pooping ferrets. Who would, I mean, I swear, is that a Vietnamese thing or is that just a Southeast Asian thing?
I don't know where this
we got to figure that out.
Indigenous to
like who thinks of that? Literally, who thinks of that shit?
That's like the caveman looking at the egg from a chicken. Come on, man. Like, who was the first one of us
right
to look at an egg and go,
yeah. I tell you what, there's a lot of dishes in the Vietnamese culture that makes you go,
It's like a haggis from Scotland. It's the same thing. Like people in desperate times and will endure desperate measures. Haggis in Scotland is the same thing.
No, what is haggis?
It's like offal cooked in a sheep's gut or sheep's stomach.
Offal. Awful. Awful. Like guts.
Guts and heart and lung and tissue and all that.
Organ. Awful is organ, right?
I had a really high-end version of it in Edinburgh, and it was really good, like a you know, bougie version. But then I had like a...
fucking Silver Lake version.
Yeah, Silver Lake version. It was literally like in like the hipster part of Edinburgh, and it was actually pretty good. And then I had like a trashy fast food version of it in Jersey at a Scottish place with a bunch of friends, and that was its own thing. It was okay. But, you know... I don't know how healthy it is, but I think it's, yeah, it's working with what you have, right?
The necessities of our dimension.
Yeah. Right. I wanted to read, so I didn't find the Kissinger quote, but I have quotes from Vietnamese people about Starbucks in Vietnam.
Okay.
Which couldn't gain a foothold, which is
very interesting,
right? That, and it makes sense. Like if you go to Vietnam and you see how many coffee options there are and how cheap they are. But someone said that it was bland and not very coffee flavored. And what I love about that quote is that the assumption is not that Starbucks tastes like coffee, because the assumption begins with Vietnamese coffee, right?
Yeah.
Vietnamese coffee tastes like coffee. Starbucks tastes like something else, which is more akin to like water or baby's milk or something.
I mean, the French call it American piss.
Right. Yeah, sure.
Coffee.
Do you think there's like some like hubris involved in that? The American Starbucks Corporation and coffee bean tea leaf coming into Vietnam and saying, this is coffee.
Ooh.
I mean, yeah. I think there's a real colonizer spirit. That's like, it's like, you know, it's they're coming into the least colonizable place in maybe the history of the world.
Because I think
they're trying to colonize coffee culture that's established on every street corner.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get it anywhere you go.
It's much more pervasive than what coffee culture is in the US, I think. Coffee culture in Vietnam is much more pervasive.
Oh, yeah.
Like more pervasive than Italy.
Yeah. I've the two places I've been the most caffeinated were Italy and Vietnam. Yeah.
But it's more caffeinated than Italy.
It is. Yeah. It's incredible. And totally, you know, ubiquitous. And Starbucks trying to gain a foothold is.
What I find interesting is that Starbucks failed in Vietnam, so it was a Arabica versus Robusta.
Yeah.
And also, Starbucks failed in Australia and New Zealand. They tried twice to enter the Australian and New Zealand markets, and they got rebuffed both times. In that situation, it was Arabica versus Arabica, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in both situations, in Vietnam and also Australia and New Zealand, they had a very firmly established coffee culture.
Yeah.
Whereas at Starbucks, like kind of sort of introduced coffee culture whole cloth to the American market back in the 1970s, 1980s. Whereas in Vietnam and Australia, they had coffee culture in Australia, you did at least from the 1950s because of the Greek and Italian migration post World War II. In Vietnam, we had coffee culture, you know, since 1857 and the French, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of somewhat hubris from Starbucks trying to enter those markets.
It's also prohibitively expensive. I mean, just based on the street value of something. So it's 90,000 dong for a cup of coffee, which is basically $380. But if you consider you can get like a bowl of pho for like $2 or $3, if you don't go to a fancy place.
It's upside down.
Yeah, it's upside down. So another quote from a random Starbucks tester. I only went to Starbucks once because I wanted to try the luxurious coffee, but I felt that the money I spent wasn't worth what I got back, so I didn't come back. Which is pretty typical.
But there is a sense of sort of classism when it comes to walking around Asia, Southeast Asia, with the Starbucks coffee in your hand.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
There's definitely that.
It's like a branded thing.
It's a brand thing, yeah.
Like wearing Levi's jeans when Vietnam reopened back in the late 80s, right?
It's a flex.
Yeah,
it's a flex. You know, you're not part of Vietnamese society. You're Western educated. You want to show signs that you've probably lived internationally, and you come back. You're not somebody from Vietnam.
It's a signal.
It's a signal.
That you're more than.
Yeah, because I think for me, I'm guilty of going to Vietnam and drinking Starbucks because I'm a cold brew drinker and I'm a creature of habit.
Oh man!
But when I'm I know crucifixion.
Well, before this, you asked if I wanted a Starbucks.
I know, and I have it right here. I know this is so evil.
Looking at this Starbucks.
It's easy on my stomach. You know, I mean, I'll break it down to you. There's no acid in here. It's as bland as it comes on your body. And
you appreciate the blandness.
I certainly
you
do.
You came for the blandness.
And when I go to Vietnam and I drink Vietnamese coffee, I am wired.
Yeah.
I'm wired. I can't turn it off for days.
I like the caffeine high. I like for me, there's not a harsh come down.
Yeah.
Something pure about it. I was kind of blown away by how caffeinated I got and then how little of a jitters.
Oh, really?
I got when I was just drinking Robusta straight, like, yeah, it was good.
Yeah. Now, this whole thing about, walking around with this logo, basically, showing signs of...
Do you hold it with the logo facing outwards to the people?
See, that I hide mine. I put it in a bag because it's embarrassing to drink, you know, Starbucks coffee in Vietnam. But for me, it's more of a health issue.
From a place of privilege. Right there, right? Whereas the people in Vietnam, they want to show you that logo.
So have they closed Starbucks down yet or no?
No, it's still there. But I think it's only in the dozens of stores. Whereas you know, they had
high traffic,
had
tourists
for like hundreds of stores in the last 15, 17 years.
You can't compete with somebody selling coffee for like 50,000 dong, you know? It's like $2 or something, you know, just down the street. It's insane. You can't. You just can't compare.
The economics aren't there. But I think that the cultural cachet isn't there either.
Yeah, apparently.
Right? And like the quote that Phil read out is that, the young people will try it once or twice just to try it out, but also for the cultural cachet. But the cultural cachet is not so overwhelming so as to surpass the actual taste and flavor that they're after, right? So that's an interesting kind of point to make right there is maybe Vietnamese people in Vietnam are not so enamored of Western stuff anymore, that they're realizing that certain elements of Vietnamese culture, whether it be pho or coffee, is in and of itself good.
Beautiful.
Enough, right?
Yep.
To survive at the table of world cuisine or world culture.
Are we going to talk about the effects of the changing climate on Robusta and Arabica and how it's changing the sort of economic models of the two beans? Do we have that set up at all?
Yeah. I mean, a little bit, right? So Robusta, by its very name, means it's more robust as a plant species compared to Arabica.
But I heard that... As the next few decades, we are approaching the next few decades, there is coffee production issues because of the change in climate.
Yeah, it's true. So in 2021, a severe frost in Brazil damaged 200,000 hectares, which are over almost 500,000 acres of predominantly Arabica coffee crops because of climate change. Which is big because Brazil is like a huge producer.
This is the number one
of Arabica. Yeah, so
number one producer in the whole world of coffee
and of Arabica
of coffee and particularly in of Arabica.
Yeah, and what we're seeing is a little bit like the original kind of Arabica problems because of the coffee leaf rust fungus that hit in the 40s and 50s in Vietnam. And if we want to use that as sort of a past as precedent, as sort of a historical precedent, Vietnam's Arabica bean production fell 64.5%. Granted, it was a much smaller amount of bean because it was, you know, produced locally and it wasn't mass produced, industrialized. But and that was in 1945. It fell to 1.7% in 1957. And this was obviously because of a fungus, not because of weather, but you could see how steep of a drop off that was in 12 years. Yeah, absolutely not resilient, which maybe bears parallels to the, to the profile and the flavor. And
yes, yeah, so I think robusted beans are more adaptable to changes or fluctuations in temperature. They're still kind of somewhat kind of susceptible to drought.
Yeah,
there is issues of drought in Vietnam, but the temperature changes are more one thing. I think if you're thinking about global climate change and how its effect on coffee production and crop production worldwide. So in the near future, in the next couple of decades, you'll probably see a reduction in Arabica bean
and a growth in Robusta
and an increase in growth in Robusta,
which means Robusta is coming, really.
Yes,
and you can't avoid it. And
And so for Starbucks spokesman to say, "Hey, we've got to double down and triple down on Arabica only," it's kind of like that's interesting kind of position for Starbucks or coffee and tea leaf to make.
Yeah, if anybody is listening from Starbucks Corporation, please contact us, C-Dreams, here at this podcast. We'd love to have you on as a discussion. As we have had on Sarah Nguyen from Nguyen Coffee Supply and Lan from Fat Milk, these wonderful people have been on our podcast, the Vietnamese podcast. And they're doing really innovative things with coffee, Robusta from Vietnam. They wear it loud and proud, and they push for it. It's amazing. I just want to bring up a really funny fact that has nothing to do with what I just brought up. It's the fact that for a country that's so laid back like Vietnam, how are we so coffee driven? Italy too. Italy's really laid back, right? They're the idea of like siesta, the idea of like not working as crazy as American culture, right? They're laid back.
Well, I think that's kind of a misnomer, right?
What do you mean? Explain.
I think Vietnamese people are very industrious.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, they're very industrious, but the way they approach this industriousness is laid back.
Okay, wait, let's really talk about this, because I think Vietnamese factories, like when you think about output, even to Chinese factories and Chinese to American factories, I mean, if you're looking at the peak production years of America, China, and Vietnam, there's like real big discrepancies in the amount of like what a factory produces per hour, per person. There's huge. There's numbers on this. Look, I'm drifting into really dark waters here.
Again, so if you talk about productivity, you're talking about things like number of man hours versus capital intensiveness, right? How much machinery?
Everything being the same, all things being equal, machinery, technology, we have had issues with output because of the culture. There's a clear, you know, speed, urgency, how close to perfection we need to get, like the Japanese. What is that? They have this idea of Kaizen.
Yeah, like continuous Toyota improvement.
Continuous improvement. We don't have that at the forefront of our factories.
I think with Japan, though, I think the whole manufacturing ethos is around scarcity. They grew up, you know, they develop with nothing, with very few limited resources.
Look,
natural resources.
I'm just bringing in coffee and production.
Yeah, I don't know if it's as one to one as like the industrial output of the country defines like its caffeine intake, right?
I think like I know.
It's also the character.
I'm not making that argument. I'm just saying Italy and Vietnam are really laid back cultures with siesta.
Let's just break down like how you just laughed at that. Because it's actually indicative of like a lot of exchanges I have with Vietnamese friends, right? You laughed at that in a way that was both laid back, but also really caffeinated. Like I could feel the presence and intensity of your laugh. And I think that defines the culture. I like all my Vietnamese friends' exchanges. Not only is it laid back, not only are we having fun, but there's a real presence and a real like energy to all those exchanges that isn't evident in every cultural exchange I have.
I am not saying our laid backness is a problem. I'm just saying the output compared to Chinese and American factories are not the same. And it's ironic because we all consume so much caffeine.
Yeah.
This highly charged caffeine.
But maybe we're doing it for fun. Maybe it's maybe it's pleasurable. Like it's really enjoyable to like get really high on caffeine with your friends and joke around and just not really do anything. And you know, I think it speaks to the leisure activities.
The joie de vivre. Well.
Yeah.
The joie de vivre of Vietnamese.
More caffeine in coffee than in tea.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I guess it depends on what kind.
Yeah. Which strain you're looking at. Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's a certain types of pork.
So, wait, are you defending this argument because you want to make light and fun of the situation?
No,
and it's fun?
No, not at all. You were describing Italy as well. And I think, yeah, there could be a laid back sort of attitude. Maybe the work ethic isn't the best in certain regions, right? It's a lot of areas of Italy not known for like their industrial output. But like, there is also like a no pun intended, a robustness to the disposition, the Italian disposition, especially when you're in Italy. There's a vibrancy. They'll sit around drinking coffee, caffeinating and just laughing for half the day, and it's great. It's like you feel alive. That's the whole point, right?
And I don't think Japan has a heavy coffee culture. I don't think so. It's a tea culture. Taiwan's a tea culture, not a coffee culture.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Why aren't those places a heavy coffee culture?
Well, Japan wasn't, you know, colonized by the French, essentially.
That's a good point.
I mean, that's probably the main point.
Or the Italians, or the Greeks.
The main point is that
Vietnam was
colonized by the French.
Thailand, sort of by the French. Not too much.
But there's not a whole lot of coffee drinking in Thailand. There's not. Hence Red Bull. You know Red Bull came from Thailand, right?
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Jakarta's place, this is totally left field, but in doing research for this coffee episode, I learned that fish sauce, the ancient Romans had fish sauce.
Mm-hmm. And it's called... Yeah.
We're going to do a fish sauce episode later on, but I just want to pinpoint that for later discussion.
That's a great one, yeah.
Yeah, when I was in Pompeii, I was just noting how similar some of the like Mediterranean cooking is to Asian cooking.
Garum. Yeah, that's what it's called.
Tons of garlic and chili on fish. And I was like, this is interesting. And you realize the trade routes all connect to the areas. Yeah. And so it makes perfect sense. They have fish sauce. Yeah.
But they were the first ones. Not Vietnam.
Wow.
Not Asia. Oh, no. It's not even contested on.
Oh, it is contested.
It is not.
There's no concrete evidence for it not being simultaneously invented in two different regions.
I don't think that you found fish sauce. I'm not saying it came from the Middle East or Greece. But the barrels, the ceramic barrels of the Middle East, the Mediterranean, they're like 5,000 years old. I don't think that we found in the records of fish sauce in Asia that long. Maybe 2000.
Fish sauce in Asia using wood and not stone?
It's a good point.
Because you've had Red Boat proprietors on your podcast.
Yes, and Sunfish Sauce too, both of them.
And they use wood. Casks.
I mean, I don't. There's no stone anywhere. It's all wood casks. Yeah, it's a great point. So, how do we really know?
So again, like I said in the previous episodes, like a lot of, I think for me, a lot of Eastern kind of history is verbal. It's not written down.
Yeah, but damn, you think about pasta coming from China,
mm-hmm.
and you think about fish sauce coming from the Mediterranean.
Well, and chili peppers. A lot of them came from Central South America.
So it's like it's all sharing things, you know, like all these regions are sharing this history of food.
Well, yeah, and then it begs the question, like, what's authentic or true to any region, right? You like, what's really definitive? But I mean, if it's been in the region and then they've refined on this recipe or this dish or this condiment for hundreds of years now, then I think it's safe to say that it belongs to that region now. Regardless of where its origins were before.
And Cafe Sida is nowhere else in the world similar to that. There's no standard deviation away from one unit of Cafe Sida anywhere, right? I mean, let's think about that. Is there any place in the world that's like, all right, well, let's just make it different and then we'll call it Cafe Sida one standard deviation removed from this place right here.
That's just very not argued a flat white. But...
Yeah, I mean, there's like a, you know, there's like a good cup of Cuban coffee and
or
know,
Turkish coffee.
A, yeah, Turkish coffee, coffee, totally. But different. They don't taste the same, though it is a similar idea, right? Like a,
yeah, it's very different.
So there's also the question, I mean, yeah, we brought up with pho, but it's, you know, if the French brought coffee to Vietnam, then are the French responsible for Café Soda or Vietnamese coffee?
Yeah, you know? I think so.
Or what about where the beans come? I mean, all the beans come from Africa. Both.
Well, that French Catholic guy in 1857 brought it from where? He brought Arabica tree from France.
Yeah.
Or from somewhere, right? It didn't come from Asia.
Right. Yeah. I mean, coffee's all, it's African sourced, or then I think it made its way to Central South America, and then it was sourced from Central South America.
Go ahead.
Here's my question. In Vietnam, is coffee the preeminent social lubricant, or is it alcohol?
Ooh, great question.
Day night.
It's a day night argument. What? During the day, it's a social lubricant for the day.
When is it, like in Vietnam, you drink coffee at nighttime too, right? I always drink coffee.
No. They're closed. Yeah. A lot of places are closed. Okay. No. Yeah, I don't think that at night. I think that it's alcohol is a huge component in Vietnam. Massive.
It's male dominated. Alcohol's
mainly. Yeah, definitely. I was going to bring up this idea of, I talk about it quite often in the last year, where I'm beginning to sort of look at the French in a very different way. And I was very angry about being shoved down my throat, religion being shoved down my throat, being Catholic and knowing that the French history in the country. And then I had to like go to church and waste many years of my life to become what my mom and dad wanted, their versions of holiness.
Apologies to existing practicing Catholics.
Yeah, apologies to them. But it's juvenile to think that that all that colonizing was a bad thing for our country, for Vietnam, right? I mean, you think about it. These things that we're talking about, like coffee and pho.
Modern language
is a huge one. You think about the architecture of Vietnam, the French architecture. And then, you know, Vietnamese people around the world, all over the world, have a love for French culture. They love French music. They love French ideas. They love French writers. They love the French language, being educated in the French ways. It's like, is it Stockholm syndrome? Many decades later.
It's arguable that the French colonization in Vietnam wasn't as extractive or as exploitive as either French colonies in, let's say, Africa or Belgian colonies in Africa or Dutch colonies in Africa. Mm. So it's not as extractive, not as exploitive, i.e. not rooted in physical violence. Whereas I think in the French in Vietnam, yes, there was violence there, but it's not as severe as in other colonies. So I think there was more room for an interplay or interchange of influences, the French influence in Vietnam.
In the last year, I've interviewed several men in their 80s and 90s that worked for the French in their 20s. They are all telling me that they got paid 10 times more than their counterparts that were working in Vietnam.
I'm sure.
10 times more.
Yeah. And a lot of the older Vietnamese that we know, you know, our grandparents or great-grandparents, and this year of sophistication, knowing French.
Because they got paid a lot more.
Well, being a francophile, being a francophone.
But so. that's a form of control, if you will, though. Right? That's the way that the French would control their subjects, is to pay their head guys in charge a lot more money. But they love it. A lot of these men love the French, you know, the people I've interviewed in the last year. And I'm beginning to change my...
I mean, that's a big incentive for colonization, right?
Yeah.
You just basically get to exploit a readily available workforce that doesn't know any better, that thinks they're getting the better end of things because of the bad exchange rate.
Or imagine paying the police force 10 times more than the regular police, and you as a French government coming in can control the whole population if you pay the Vietnamese men 10 times more.
That's just colonial rule, is just kind of jerry-rigging servitude, right? Yeah. Yeah. And it's subjugation. I mean, it's horrific. Yeah.
I think it's similarly to, like, I think the Westernization or Americanization of Japanese, you know.
After the war, post-war.
In Japan.
But I mean, just stepping back, like, I feel like I'm guilty of a lot of, like, gentrifier tendencies. I mean, cities I've lived in after Hawaii, I lived in Portland, Brooklyn, and now East LA. Like, it's just...
They're all defund the police. They're all defund the police cities.
Ironic mustache.
Yeah, it's like I would be in the middle of a target for, like, anti-gentrification, you know? But there are aspects to it that, I guess are progressive. There are a lot of really negative aspects. The older I get, the more negative the whole thing seems, the more of a farce it all seems. But when I look at, like, and I don't think it's gentrification, but when I look at what the Vietnamese interpretation of French culture is, it's sort of this reverse gentrification.
Mm.
Granted, they were the subjugated, right? But they're now taking the kind of ruling class's culture and incorporating it into their own recipes, into their own culture. And I just think people in Vietnam that, like, did that, the OG reverse gentrifiers of French colonists, I mean, how all the brilliant recipes and the incredible inspiration that came out of it. I just like to see more reverse gentrified
situations. But is it reverse gentrification? Is it reverse gentrifiers, or is it appropriation of your masters?
What do you think? I mean, that's a great question. That's, like, sort of an evergreen question, you know? I don't know. I mean, I think it's working again. It's like the beef bone pho, or it's like the condensed milk. It's like working with what you've got. It's all you've got. You're compromised. And especially if you're under the thumb of a ruling class who, if they haven't effectively subjugated you physically, then they're doing it economically, right? And they're doing it culturally, and they're winning. Like, that, you using whatever you can to kind of take from their influence and make it your own, so you maintain some sense of identity. And culture is a pretty brilliant strategy.
I always try to figure out why is the things that we're talking about important, and like coffee and all this culture, why is it important? I think to live within all of the context of everything and understanding it gives us a richer life. Because if we don't, everything's binary, right? Like social media, politics today, everything's binary. The beauty, I think, of living here in this space, and I'm not tooting our own horn here in this podcast, is that you want to label something in a restaurant in Silver Lake Vietnamese coffee, then we should know better and we should address these things. And that's, like, the micro level, but the bigger responsibility of, I think, citizens and humanity in general is that we don't mislabel things. And that we call things out for what they are and are able to identify what things really are for what they really are, instead of, like, blurring lines.
This gets back to what Sarah from
When Coffee Supply
and Lan basically says that at the moment we're in the third wave of coffee, right? So the first wave of coffee is about cheap commodified coffee for the masses, right? So that happened, let's say, post-World War II, 1950s, 1960s. The second wave was when they started, you know, trying to look to single origin and having a much more intermediate understanding where coffee is or where its coffee come from. The third wave is where, you know, you have specialty coffee houses, you know, the intelligentsias of Blue Bottle, etc., where it's about the experience and the stuff around the bean itself. I think we're probably heading towards the end of maybe this third wave and beginning of the fourth wave, right? And so what is the fourth wave of coffee? Is it a focus on sustainability? Is it a focus on the cultural aspects the cultural authenticity of coffee, right? Is it a focus on the relationship of coffee to white society?
Yeah, I was just going to say
that's the fourth wave to me, right? And we're on the precipice, I think, of the fourth wave.
It's marketing. It's integrating Robusta into Western society.
Because it's an alternative storyline, right? The existing storyline of coffee is in Western cultures, it's Arabica. It's subtlety, it's nuance. Now there's a new storyline in coffee, in the coffee culture, and it's Robusta. It's bold, it's flavorful, it's more innovative.
That's the fourth wave of Vietnamese coffee?
No, I think it's the fourth wave of coffee, period, right? Is having more stories that are outside of the mainstream, that are outside of the current trendsetters or people who gatekeep what is.
So is this fourth wave affecting Vietnam?
I think Vietnam can be a big player in this fourth wave.
How?
Well, it's the expertise in Robusta, for example, right? It's not a flavor profile that is prevalent or well-known or well-understood in Western coffee culture, right? So we, Vietnamese purveyors of coffee and then coffee houses can speak with some authenticity. That requires education, et cetera, et cetera. Because by the dint that we are non-mainstream and non-Western, we can speak to authenticity, right? About certain things. Hey, coffee culture does not mean a hot cup of coffee, right? It can mean cafe soda. Coffee need not be essentially a savory thing, not sweet thing. It can have sweetened condensed milk. It need not have dairy. It can have egg
coffee. Or durian.
Or durian, right? And so we can speak with we, meaning Vietnamese people, being large bean growers, Robusta especially. We can speak with authenticity to that. And it's a fourth wave. It's about adding in culture, understanding of culture, adding
a story,
intentionality to that, I think, which is missing currently.
So I want to transition into the conclusion, which I'm going to start with this idea of what the Thai government did for Thai restaurants in the United States. Governments play a huge role in films such as Korea and what Korean did to their hardware, like LG, Samsung. They needed people to consume on hardware. So they go and they pump up K-pop, they pump up K-dramas and build this robust film industry and entertainment industry. How does the government of Vietnam, a so-called communist government, get involved with turning Vietnam into a branding machine? How do we go and get communists? How did communists go corporate? I would love to think about that as the next topic.
Well, South Korea wasn't communist.
Sure.
Right?
But well, I'm talking about Vietnam right now. How did Vietnam go corporate?
I mean, that's another series of episodes we can talk about.
Now. Yeah. And I think that's, because as we're talking about this, I'm like, I don't hear, maybe I'm just ignorant to it, but I don't hear the Vietnamese government pushing coffee or standing behind Robusta. Maybe they do. Maybe they subsidize. I don't know. I'd love to know. I'd love to know how the government of Vietnam has gone corporate today. And I think it has.
Well, I think there has to be room for kind of an industrial, like a good work ethic and an entrepreneurialism, right? Especially if it's like a part of the spirit of a people. Because if you sort of stifle that, and you just end up with like oppression or rebellion.
Yeah. I mean, Singapore did something right.
Well, I also think it's good for the general economy to allow.
I think one of the assumptions of what you said, and it's like 5 minutes ago, it's like
Do we agree that Vietnamese people are innovative and industrious?
Yeah. Do we not? Yeah, sure. We do. Yeah. We do. I think we do. I think the underlying agreement is we do.
Okay. And that industriousness and innovation exists whether it's under a capitalist system, a colonial system, or a communist system, right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, it does.
So one of the implications of your statement is what is a communist government doing to push this?
Yeah. But to protect it.
My push back to that is, why do we need the government to intervene in that? If the underlying assumption is that Vietnamese people are going to be industrious.
Because you could be good, but I think you need to be helped by the government to be great. Case in point with Korea. Case in point with Thai restaurants in the United States. You know, the government of Thailand really pushed for this to make it happen. And I think governments around the world need to do what they need to do to make their people, the people of their country, a brand. I talk about that all the time.
Are you talking about soft power?
Absolutely. Yeah. As it relates to this.
You know, researching the Pho episode, there was a great example where there were all these government reforms. I think it might have been during the Doi Moi, or it might have been earlier.
During like 87,
right. But there were these government reforms, and as a result, you had to have like some sort of government-sanctioned businesses. So a lot of businesses were operating almost like, the DMV or something, right? And there were pho shops that couldn't put out the freshest ingredients and couldn't put out the best noodles. And they actually had to have like kind of half-rotten food on display. And the shop owners would use that display, and underneath it, they'd hide
the
fresh stuff.
The good stuff.
And then you'd come by and you'd pay, and then they'd pull out every, it created basically an instant black market.
Yep.
Right. And I think any government that was aware of that and realizing that went on wide, scale would want to sanction it, would want to work with it rather than against it.
Yeah.
Because that's so much of the innovation of the people and the potential of the, even just the business opportunities of the government itself. So, I just think, it made sense that was sort of reformed out and a certain style of free market and actual like business and capitalism was embraced. But I think that all has to be within the realm of, I guess,
I think too, the implication there or suggestion, right? One is, does government get out of the way of grassroots innovation and development, or does government need to have an active push?
It's hard to separate our culture from this idea of who the government is. I think who the government is who the people of Vietnam are. We are a hierarchical society. We are a society that, traditionally we don't like to support our children in ways that are frivolous or are not, it's we want them to become doctors, we want them to become lawyers, but we don't see anything. Just I God, this is going to be painful to say, but I think when we think about government, I think in Vietnam, I think about the government being very similar to the culture,
meaning paternalistic,
hierarchical, paternalistic, patriarchal. I think
Confucian.
Americans are
individualistic.
We don't use honorifics. We use you and me. You and me are on the same page. You're not higher than me. I'm not higher than you. We're in the same page, and it's a meritocracy. And I think
I argue against meritocracy.
Sure. All right. Well, it's all relative. But I'm saying when we go into our next topic and we're talking about supporting structures of these different things like coffee or pho or Thai restaurants or the entertainment industry for Vietnamese people, I think we do need to start talking about different countries in Southeast Asia that have done it right. And then maybe kind of talk about
that. What right though, King?
I think Singapore has done it really right. from an economic, financial point of view.
But not from a civil rights perspective.
Sure. I mean, but that's an American and a Western thing to say.
Perhaps so.
Well, we definitely need to get into this.
So to close out the coffee, from my perspective, Vietnamese coffee requires three elements. Robusta beans, the thin filter, and
condensed milk.
Sweetened condensed milk. I think from another point I'd like to make is it's interesting to me personally how the three kind of big markers of Vietnamese cuisine in Western culture is pho, Vietnamese coffee, and banh mi. Like, out of all those three things, they're French influenced. And they're fairly recent additions, yet Vietnam has somehow co-opted or developed these three things, which has colonial influence.
But maybe that's
to be like the Vietnamese identity to the rest of the world.
But that's maybe the reason why those three were quote unquote selected to be the identity.
Did Vietnamese people select it?
No.
Did the diaspora select it?
No, I think the Western world found it easy to kind of pick those three things.
Because it was
because there's
and relatable to
there are genetics in it,
right? I just think about like comparisons and parallels, and I think about like Highland Park, for example, right? One of the most gentrified hip neighborhoods in Los Angeles. A complete transformation in the last like 20 years, right? A lot of rich kids posing as broke hipsters, buying houses with their parents' money, but not to sound cynical, but that's what it is. And you think about the original residents of Highland Park who have mostly been displaced now, right?
All
pretty much. But if you think about them still having a foothold in Highland Park, rising up one day and throwing out all of these rich brat hipsters, no offense if you live in Highland Park, and then taking all of the recipes, all of the bougie cafes, all of the vegan, organic fair trade restaurants, and then
farm to table,
and then just no offense to vegans or fair trade activists, taking all these farm to table restaurants and then just occupying them and cooking their own food in these restaurants and using all the Highland Park ingredients and then selling that to the rest of Los Angeles. That would pretty much be like what Vietnam is doing right now.
Reverse colonialism.
So badass, if you think about it.
It's post-colonialism.
It's post-colonialism. And it's so unbelievably subversive. And it defies categorization. And it's incredible. It's just off the charts. If I witnessed that, I would be laughing and crying at the same time.
But doesn't that speak to, like, for me, it's... I think the Vietnamese people, Vietnamese culture, there's a survivalist element to it, right? We survived the Chinese. Survived the French.
But you can make the same argument for what the Japanese did for the production line, Henry Ford, after the war, right? They took something that the victors did well and they did it better.
Yeah, but I think the way they did that was they adopted and adapted and put in a uniquely Japanese spin.
Sounds like what the Vietnamese are doing. Sounds exactly what the Vietnamese are doing. I think it's human nature that we adapt, overcome, and make things better.
With that,
come to an end. It's a great, I had a lot of fun.
Yeah. A lot of hows and whys were kind of answered and probed today.
Yeah. We'll pick up the next episode. Everybody, I want to thank everybody for joining us today. It was a hope we helped question and create more questions for your brains to think about for the next few weeks.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody. So we all were sitting around after the podcast had ended and we were sitting there kicking ourselves in the butt, trying to figure out who said that quote that we were trying to figure out earlier. And turns out it wasn't Kissinger. It was actually the U.S. General William Westmoreland. And he actually said in a 1974 documentary, Hearts and Minds, Westmoreland was interviewed and he infamously said, the Oriental doesn't put the same high price on life as does a Westerner. Life is plentiful. Life is cheap in the Orient. And I think that is sort of the reflective kind of nature that we were thinking about when we were thinking about that Starbucks comparison from Arabica to Robusta.
And I mistook it for Kissinger. Apologies. I actually found the quote that I thought Ken was referencing, but Kissinger said, depopulation should be the highest priority of U.S. foreign policy toward the third world.
I don't know what's worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you can weigh in, listeners.
That is pretty rough.
Who's the bigger villain?
Please leave a quote. Please leave a comment or something. I mean, it's crazy that we even have to bring this stuff up as we're talking about coffee, right? I mean, that's sort of like.
Yeah, but I think this is a bit of like the history of Southeast Asia, right? And we haven't always been the authors of our own destiny in this region. And it has been seen significant foreign influence. I think this podcast needs to explore that in future sessions.
I agree. That's very, very true.
And I think subjects that seem almost as you know, benign and innocuous as like a food dish or a drink. It's something pleasurable, something, you know, cultural, can be a great window into like some of these deeper, darker issues.
Politics, the economics, the cultural kind.
It may seem unfair playing devil's advocate to compare Henry Kissinger's war policy to the landscape of coffee, but
no, but there's a lot of parallels there.
Yeah,
there's a lot.
And I think they're warranted in a way.
And it goes back to what An was saying. It's like we haven't traditionally been the authors of our own narratives. Let's really confront that fact. I think as we start to develop our own voice about Southeast Asia as it relates to Vietnam or Singapore, all these places, we need to start figuring out who is the authors of these narratives.
And whose voice do we choose to listen to?
Yeah.
Because just right then, right, we sought out the quote by Kissinger. We sought out
Westmoreland.
Why do we seek out quotes by Vietnamese people?
Because we don't know any.
Exactly.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning into that last part.